16. Under Observation. After spending some time in the library, Murdo climbed the stairs to the bridge. Several men and women in blue uniforms stood at various stations. One man was looking through a brass-plated viewing device that had been lowered from the ceiling. A periscope, of course. One woman was at the helm, and another read numbers aloud from a dial. He was fairly certain she was speaking Spanish. It was a language of which she had learned only a few words. Murdo searched his brain for the little he knew about submarine ships. There would have to be some sort of ballast tanks to control buoyancy. He assumed some of those levers emptied or filled the tanks. Mr. Socrates would want to know. And at some point, such knowledge might be necessary to his own survival. Murdo climbed to the top of the stairs and went down the passage. The door to his room was open a crack. He was certain he had left it closed. He slowly pushed it open. His tiny cabin was empty, the cot still unmade, the drawer on the dresser pulled out an inch. Someone had been through his room, clearly not caring if he knew it. He closed the door, patted under the mattress, and found the wireless telegraph. At least that was safe. In a code Mr. Socrates would recognize, he typed, "Agent Murdo, stop. Aboard submarine ship, stop." There was no way for him to receive a message, and this would only work if the Actinio happened to be passing by one of the transatlantic cables. What chance was there of that? He typed the message again and a third time, then slid the wallet under the mattress. Mr. Socrates would be pleased to learn of the Actinio's existence. An underwater ship such as this would make Britain the master of the world's oceans. The Germans, the French, and the Russians wouldn't dare cross swords with an empire that could sink ships with such stealth. The Actinio thrummed and sat perfectly balanced in the water. Murdo's only complaint was the humid heat, probably caused by the build-up of human-expelled air. Feeling stifled and tired, Murdo decided that a short nap would restore his energy. Maybe then he'd be able to shift his face. Since there was no lock on the door, he turned his back to it and removed his mask. He heard a gasp. With his heart racing, he slipped the mask on again. The door was closed, the room empty. Perhaps there was a pinhole and someone was watching him through it. He searched the walls from floor to ceiling, then climbed onto his cot, looking in every corner, shielding his eyes from the light. Nothing. When he turned back to the door, it was ajar. A spy. Murdo shoved the door closed. It was clear someone had seen his face and been shocked, but who? He removed the small oval mirror from the wall. Nothing unusual there. No pinholes. Had the spy been peeking in the door? He felt betrayed. In his few minutes with Captain Monturiel, he had realized that she was ruthless with her enemies, but had an honorable side. Spying didn't seem to be her mode of operation. At the moment, nothing could be done. He would have to dine with her soon, and that meant uncovering his mouth to eat. His muscles were tired, and though he no longer felt the chill, he was still weak from his ordeal in the frigid water. Maybe if he concentrated on just his face and hump, he could at least make himself more presentable. And so he worked on his muscles and bones, making his nose rise, smoothing his jaw into the noble line of the night, forcing his hump to recede. When he was done, he pulled on a jacket. It was too large, which was good, since it hid his imperfections. His reflection in the mirror was respectable enough. The lightning bolt hands of his clock pointed to 5 minutes before 1900 hours. He went out into the hall. One of Monturiel's men was already waiting.
"Hello, sir," Murdo said.
On second glance, he saw that the man was in fact a square-jawed, broad-shouldered woman with a grim countenance. She shook her head. Either she didn't want to talk or she couldn't speak English. "Hola," he said, hoping for a response. She motioned for him to follow her down the corridor toward the bow. They took the catwalk across the Actinio's bridge, where the comrades were still at their stations. He was led down a corridor with a dozen or so cabins on either side. If each held one sailor, Murdo calculated, there would be at least 20 on the ship. Unless, of course, there were more cabins on the lower deck, or more men per cabin. They stopped in front of a large door.
The woman knocked, then slid the door aside to reveal a small dining room. Colette was already seated at a shining maple table, set with the finest cutlery, golden goblets at each of the six settings. Having guided Modo to his seat across from Colette, the comrade left.
"Ah, you do clean up well, Monsieur Walken," Colette said. "And you aren't hiding behind your mask."
"My affliction was temporary."
"Well, I'm glad to hear that. I feel much better talking with you now that I can see your face."
The door slid open and Captain Monturiel walked in. She sat at the far end of the table.
"Greetings. First, I feel I must clarify something. I do not want you to think this is the head of the table. I would have placed a round table in here, but that was not feasible with the dimensions of a submarine ship."
Once more the door slid open. Serdar and a young comrade with short, bristly hair entered the room.
"Ah, here you are," the captain said. "Comrade Serdar and Comrade Garry will be joining us tonight. I dine with different members of the crew each evening. No one person is more important than the next."
The men took their places. Comrade Garay nodded to Modo, and his eyes lingered on Colette. She gave Garay a wide smile, which, to Modo's surprise, left him a little envious.
"Remember," he told himself, "you're a married man. Besides, why would he feel jealous?
Octavia most certainly had his heart." A side door leading to the galley opened, and a female comrade brought in two silver plate dishes and set them down on the table.
"Gracias," the captain said. It sounded Spanish, but Modo knew gracias was the proper word. What language was she speaking?
Monturiel lifted the lids.
"Please, Mr. Walken, as our newest guest, you may serve yourself first."
Modo squinted at the steaming meat. Some sort of dark organ cut into six pieces, all exactly the same size. He served himself a section, along with what looked like squid and an unfamiliar red and black leafy vegetable.
"May I ask what this meat is?" he said.
Captain Monturiel laughed.
"An Icarian speciality. Please try it. I am curious to hear your thoughts."
Modo found that it melted in his mouth, leaving a pleasant, briny aftertaste.
"It's wonderful. It is seal liver. The other is squid, and the salad is dulse seaweed harvested off the coast of Ireland."
"Seaweed?" Modo poked it with a fork.
"Yes, everything is from our mother, the ocean. She is rich beyond all imagination. While the capitalists fight over the carcass of the earth, we live on the ocean's bounties."
"Well, it's certainly a fine meal," Modo said, sipping his wine.
"That is aged fish wine," Serdar explained.
Modo didn't mind the taste, but had no desire to learn how fish wine was made.
"I'm not accusing anyone," Captain Monturiel said, looking at Modo and Colette. "But some of our stores have gone missing. Fruit, in this case. Rescued from a sunken ship. Aboard the Ictinia we are to share all food, all riches, equally."
"I didn't take it," Modo said.
"Nor I," added Colette. "I am only making you aware of the theft. It could very well have been a citizen of Icaria."
Comrade Garay coughed uncomfortably.
"I'm not accusing anyone at the table," Captain Monturiel repeated.
Then she smiled, as if to dismiss any unpleasantness, and raised her goblet.
"Welcome aboard, Mr. Walken."
They clinked goblets, and Modo sipped more wine. He rarely drank alcohol, so he wanted to be certain to not have too much.
"I have a question," he said.
Monturiel lifted her goblet again.
"Please, ask. We will answer anything within reason. Well, you are the captain of the vessel, correct? But every other, seaman, seawoman I've met is called a comrade. I thought ships had coxswains, masters, ensigns, and so on."
"Ah, there are no ranks here, though every comrade has his or her job. I was elected captain 5 years ago for a 10-year term. So, in consultation with my fellow comrades, I made the decisions for the Ictinio and all of Icaria."
"So it's like being a queen," Colette said.
Monturiel set down her goblet so hard some of the wine spilled.
"It is nothing like that.
We Icarians are from all stations in life. Barrel makers, factory workers, soldiers, poets, engineers, and from many different countries. But we all had one dream, to throw off the class system shackles of the modern world. Our research and actions are all directed toward the creation of Icaria.
Modo tasted some of the seaweed, which was salty and had a spicy dressing. He decided it would be best to change the topic.
You said you would explain what powers the lights of your craft. I have never been inside such a well-lit ship.
May I answer? Sedar asked.
It is only right, Monturiel said. You installed the system.
Based on your father's designs.
Yes, but you gave it life. Such modesty does a disservice to your contributions.
Sedar shrugged.
You want to know about our secret agent? He said.
Modo's stomach did a somersault. Had they seen through him already? Even Colette was gripping her fork tightly, her face momentarily frozen. But Sedar's smile was friendly, and he spoke enthusiastically.
The agent we use to power nearly every apparatus aboard this ship is electricity.
Electricity?
Modo squeaked in relief, then cleared his throat.
But how is that possible? It can only be used to power small devices.
Sedar pointed to the light above them.
It was only a matter of being inventive. We have harnessed this power and bent it to our use. No massive stores of coal to carry. No belching steam engines to fill our ship with smoke. Electricity is the very soul of the Actinio.
But, Modo said, how can you produce enough?
Monturiel laughed.
Both she and Sedar were looking at him as though he were a child.
The answer is all around you, Sedar explained. The ocean itself. We have developed a process that uses the chloride of sodium in the water. It is an endless supply. I can explain no more than that, for the rest is a rather complicated state secret.
The thought absolutely staggered Modo. Ships that could travel the length and breadth of the ocean without stopping for coal. This would change the world. He had to contact Mr. Socrates.
You are shocked, my friend, Monturiel said, then stifled a small laugh.
She raised her goblet toward Modo again.
It is an honor to have an artist among us. We happen to have photographic equipment that will be of use to you. Mr. Walken, we would like you to capture photographs of Icaria.
Oh, wonderful,
Modo said, trying to sound pleased, when the truth was he knew little about photography.
Yes, what sort of photographic device would you use for underwater landscapes?
Colette asked.
What plates would work on the ocean floor? I don't actually know of any equipment that would work, Mademoiselle Brunette, Modo said. Water would, of course, ruin the insides. The camera would also require a lens that could capture imaginary countries, Colette said.
Montoriel smiled coldly.
You mock me still. Tomorrow you'll laugh from the other side of your mouth. I'll show you the real Icaria. Both of you, if you are willing, shall take a walk with me.
On an island? Modo asked.
No, Mr. Walken. We are going to walk upon the Icarian ocean floor.